With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello and welcome to the Friday Special, a podcast by Guitar Nerds. Now for 2020, the Friday Special series is running almost every week. And each time I'll have a new guest from the world of guitars, amplification and effects pedals. We're going to have brands, producers and musicians. I am your host, Joe Branton, joined by our special guests, Rory Friars and Niall Kennedy, the dual guitarists of And So I Watch You From Afar. Hello, fellas, and welcome to the show.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
Yes, all good. Thank you very much for coming on and joining us for this episode. Now, for listeners, if you're not familiar with And So I Watch You From Afar, they're a largely instrumental Belfast-based band who've had a massive impact on the math rock scene over the last 15 years. I think it would be fair to say that both guitarists have inspired a genre that is now kind of the torchbearer for effects-driven guitar playing and big pedal boards. So for this episode, I'm really looking forward to taking you, dear listener, on a journey into the world of their weird guitar noises. Yes. Now, I met you guys back in 2013 when And So I Watch You From Afar played a warm-up show at Brighton Electric Studios just before the first ever Arctangent Festival. And Arctangent, for those who don't know, is the UK's best and biggest experimental music festival. And I think at that show, you guys, you played a rehearsal room that was suitable for about 20 people tops, with about 60 people crammed in. And of course, the next day you went on to like headline Arctangent to sort of 7,000 or 8,000 people. And that's really kind of the crux of And So I Watch You From Afar for me. You bring this this DIY nature, despite having outgrown being a DIY band. And I see that in everything from your pedal boards to your performances. Has that been like a conscious decision within the band, or do you just like having the crack, as you would say?
No. Nice, yeah. No, I don't think that's interesting. It's interesting to hear someone's sort of objective opinion of stuff. And I mean, from the get go, I mean, we were very like, we grew up on the north coast of Antrim, on the outskirts of some little seaside towns, and like, it kind of, I suppose it instilled a, like, there wasn't much happening, you know, there certainly wasn't many venues, there wasn't many even places to pick up, you know, CDs. It was, you know, a very rural, small place. And so it instilled this kind of like, if, you know, the gig that you imagine you want to be a part of, you kind of had to create it yourself. You had to like start the band, you know, get your friends to come, find some PA. And that was just that, you know, it's that simple kind of analogy was kind of, you know, just instilled. That's how stuff gets done. You kind of, if you want it to happen, you can just do it. And yeah, I mean, And as you rightly said, the crack definitely plays a big part too, because, I mean, obviously it is great crack playing, you know, headlining a festival to thousands of people. But, I mean, it would be a shame that then suddenly meant that you couldn't do those, you know, almost arguably even more vital and visceral and experiences of, you know, being, you know, 2 feet away from somebody, you know, face to face in a rehearsal room with everybody drinking beers and letting loose, and like, you know what I mean. Yeah. Those were always the markers of something important. Like the most formative moments of my life as a somebody watching and experiencing music rarely were those moments, you know, being at the big show, the festival. It was, you know, being in front of my friend's band whenever I was 15 or 16 and feeling like I was, you know, transcending, you know, the into some new space. And I guess that's what, I don't know, you just, it almost hasn't changed, you know, since then. We just get to like do some other cool stuff.
I mean, that's definitely kind of how it feels from watching And So I Watch You From Afar. Like, nothing changes, you know, depending on where you're playing. Your the amount of energy in an And So I Watch You From Afar show is like, you know, a sort of a hungry band who've just sort of made their first record, and you manage to bring that energy, like I say, whether you're in a rehearsal studio or headlining a festival. And I think that's kind of become one of the backbones, or the cornerstone rather, that for what people think of And So I Watch You From Afar, is that you are a lot of fun in a live format. Have you found that makes the balance between performing live and creating records skewed in any way? Do you feel more like one is more important to the other? And I guess I'm going to move that into a gear question about how you address a live performance and recording when you're so kind of effects driven, when, you know, running around the stage so much, you know, must impact upon how you're going to create the amount of sounds that you do.
Yeah. I guess it has done in the past. I think it's why we try and, like, we had an album that we made. It was our third album, called All Hail Bright Futures, and it was essentially impossible to play almost. We went into the studio and we recorded it, you know, over a long period of time, you know, in a very luxurious length of time. We wrote songs in the studio. We kind of, you know,
always dangerous.
Yeah, it was dangerous, and we got the bill at the end of it. So keep the experimentation out of the studio, I think, unless you're, you know, Radiohead. But subsequently we came out having had one of the most wonderful creative experiences in the studio. But then we got out and we realized, you know, there's guitar parts for, you know, first and foremost, there's guitar parts on here, and, you know, there's six guitar parts, and we only have two guitarists. Are you know, there's a whole array of effects on this, which you know, to go from, you know, section A to section B, you know, is going to require, you know, seven separate pedals to be switched on and off. And yeah, then going forward, there was like a bunch of songs, I guess, we just never played off that.
That would have been like the first record that you started using the Line 6 M13 for live stuff. That was kind of your move into big multi effects, to do multiple effect switching. And I think, Niall, you were at the time using an M9, which, Rory, you used previously, didn't you? And then moved on to the Line 6 M13.
Yeah, that's right.
I think Rory broke his M9 and decided that if he was going to buy a new one, he might as well get a slightly bigger one. Because
was that move into multi effects because of the record, do you think?
Yeah, directly. Yeah, we didn't have those pedals while we were recording, but it was, and I'd kind of, I mean, I don't know. I feel like everyone of a certain generation has that sort of inbuilt, like, you know, you kind of scoff a bit at multi effects because, you know, everybody had this.
I was going to ask you about this because you have said in the past, like, it been, you know, a bit like, you know, multi effects. And for me, I feel like the industry has disregarded that a long time ago. But potentially, I think maybe around the time when you were making this record, you would have been right on the cusp of it being acceptable, especially in sort of the circles that we all move in, where everyone is, you know, big pedal boards, and it's important to have the individual tone of a stomp box.
Yeah.
It was like a real functionality thing, wasn't it? It was like, if we want to recreate these sounds live, we just have to do this, or else there's no really other way around it. We had to buy a sampler as well, and we're using like a live... It was a Native Instruments machine.
Oh, yeah.
So we had like a laptop, and I was like queuing up like all these different sounds off the record. And
well, I didn't know that. Did
you? Yeah, wow. It was a period of about probably less than a year, right, Rory?
Yeah, it was kind like, of
we retired it as soon as we could because it was a laptop on stage with us kind of thrashing around. And
oh, that's always asking for trouble.
Yeah,
so that was short-lived, was it? Having a laptop on stage.
There was a couple of times the laptop failed at the start of the show, and it was really stressy for me. Yeah. But it was cool. It was fun to have like all these other weird sounds and textures going on. And it was cool to like try and recreate that record live. It was almost like remixing the album a little bit live because you could never get all the sounds, but you could kind of do a bit of a version of it.
Were you aiming to recreate the album, or were you just trying to create something new for a live setting?
I think we started off trying to recreate it as much as we could. Yeah, didn't we? I mean,
and then you just
in my memory, and then. You kind of get so far, but then
yeah,
you're like,
you settle for as close as you've got, yeah. I guess. Yeah. Did you feel that you sacrificed anything at that point? Because you know, of course, multi effects have become something that you've used ever since. But did you feel at the time like you were making any tonal sacrifices by replacing some of the stuff you were doing with a Line 6 M13?
I mean,
M series in it.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of did, but you know, it's funny, like, I was still using a digital delay at the time anyway, but I guess you get used to your kind of like these little singular boxes that are hardy, and you know, you everything's there on the front of it, there's no screen, and you kind of become quite, I mean, it becomes a bit of an extension of yourself. You know exactly, you know, where to go and what to do. And I really hated going to the multi-effect stuff. And like, I'm still not a fan, you know, and it was, I don't know if it, you know, I felt like the tones and the sounds like weren't quite what I wanted. I could never quite, but I don't know if that was, maybe there was part of that, which was just an association with, you know, just me being a bit frustrated at having something that was so fiddly and you know, the buttons broke often, and I preferred it, you know. I'll always be the guy who, you know, kind of, I don't know if I'm like, I don't know, I sometimes I'd just rather, you know, old school, just have a big string of pedals all like plugged in together, kind of like
I mean, that comes with its own yeah, issues, you know. For
totally, I mean, of course, practically, you know, that wouldn't work, and that you know, I'm kind of being facetious there, but you know, it's I suppose yeah, it's but in terms of functionality, I mean, it was great and a bit of a game changer, and you know, enabled us to sort of travel, and you know, you could stick everything, yeah, on a flight and go to the States and come off, and you know, everything was there and stuck to the board still. And
yeah, that's a big advantage to the M13. The M13 is still massive, and I think whilst I can't remember when was this, like 2014, 2015, I think maybe you made the change. Am I right?
Yeah.
Somewhere around there. I can't remember when exactly that record came out, so when you would have been playing after that, but certainly around then. And I think back then, whilst you didn't have things that have become really commonplace today, like the Boss ES5 and ES8, there were still switches around, like the OctaSwitch and Gig Rig, you know, already kind of existed. Was there a reason that you didn't opt for real pedals and a switching system for them, you know, instead of a multi-effects? Or, you know, was it just the Line 6 was what you came across?
Yeah, I think it was for such a small amount of stuff that I particularly needed the any of the M series stuff. There was just like kind of four patches for these like four particular songs, which just had like, you know, I just needed, you know, whatever it was, a delay, a compressor, a little bit of a specific, you know, octoverb and you know, whatever it happened to be. And I just needed to know that I could just hit the one button. But it was.
Plus, there was some new sounds on the Line 6 pedals that we didn't necessarily, you know, like sounds that we made in the studio. We didn't necessarily have pedals that did that, if you know what I mean. So there was like, you know, sounds that we were able to create on the Line 6.
Well, the M series is so kind of consistently, you know, it's so legendary now, even though it's been out of production for, you know, the 9 and the 13 have been out of production. The 5 they still make, crazily. Yeah. But, you know, and when they introduced the legacy setting, so all of the M series sounds onto the Helix, that was something everyone really wanted. It is a very highly regarded unit. I think I agree with you, Rory. The problem with those old M series things was that at the time Line 6 were using their own proprietary foot switches, and they were the same that were going on the DL4s at the time. And anyone who's owned a Line 6 DL4 knows that 90% of the time you're replacing the foot switches in them. I think the M series had the same. They just weren't incredibly rugged. Certainly not when you guys are dancing around the stage and stamping on the pedals.
Yeah, I think we went through like 3 M9s. And Rory's
that's
got,
quite expensive.
I think Rory's M13 that he's got now has like 3 or 4 functioning switches at this point.
Oh wow, that is a massive pedal board to have to lug around.
Yeah. It's like the biggest octave pedal on earth.
That's great. Yeah, amazing. Well, I guess we are kind of fully into pedals, so I'll continue. I had this whole plan to sort of throw things on their head and talk about sort of guitars and amplifiers first, because there's some really exciting things and weird things on both of those fronts as well. But kind of on the effects pedal thing, I haven't seen either of your guys' pedal boards in a while. But like Rory, you used to have more delay pedals than really made sense for people to have on a pedal board. How many individual, because you tend to have so many different types of delay, and because you're dancing around so much when you play, I guess you assign individual sounds to individual pedals and then just have several of them on a board. What are you rocking on your current board?
I've still got two Boss DD6s, and I've got a Earthquaker Avalanche Run.
It's fantastic, the Avalanche Run.
It's absolutely beautiful. And then Earthquaker Disaster Transporter Senior.
You've both got one of those, right? The Disaster Transporter Senior.
Yeah. That would be a hard pedal for either of us to ever get rid of.
Let's stick on that for a minute, because that was a really early pedal for Earthquaker devices. And I don't know much about sort of, you know, how you guys got on board with them, but certainly you seem to have quite a relationship with that brand, who are, you know, kind of very close to our hearts here at Guitar Nerds. And they've done so much for sort of weird music, I think, through the years.
Massively. I think they sent like a huge box of pedals to Sergeant House, and then when we stopped by when we were in LA to check in with them, Kathy was just like, do you guys want to take some pedals? And we just rubbished through and took as many as we could.
Wow.
And I think we only had one disaster transport, and then as soon as we got home, we ordered another one and a couple other things off them. I got like the rainbow machine and the Afterneath, I think it's called.
Yeah, the Afterneath. What is that? What is the after? That's the. Is that a reverb or an octave? I can't remember.
It's like a kind of really eerie, spacey reverb machine. But it's a powerful beast. It can get out of control very, very quickly.
What do you use the rainbow machine for?
Actually, we just put out a little EP with some songs that didn't make it onto Airs, an EP called Successors, like 2 weeks ago. And there's a song on there called Radagast, and you'll hear the rainbow machine all over it. It's kind of just does this kind of strange noise that I'm not sure I know how to describe, but it's all over that song.
Wow. Yeah.
So kind of more of as a kind of sound effect as opposed to playing notes with on, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely. I mean, it can come down to sort of being a very simple pedal, the rainbow machine. Yeah. Like, you know, Nick Reinhardt's the first to point out that he uses his just as a chorus, and nothing else. But it's that magic control obviously makes it capable of everything from complete madness, you know, right down to actual functional sound. But yeah, it's good to see it still being used. I feel like it's one of those pedals that has a legendary reputation, especially, you know, obviously for Earthquaker. But you're starting to see it less and less these days on functional boards.
I think you have to be pretty clued in to be able to sort of wield it. It's capable of a lot, but it takes someone who really knows how to dial it in to make it functional, I think.
Yeah. What was it? What was it about the disaster transport that made you both want to go for that? Especially Rory, as you have so many other, because what do you have? Like a memory man, you had a couple of samplers on your board. Don't you have the Giga delay as well as?
Yes, I did have that for a while. I guess like the reason for all the delays is each one's just doing like a very different job, like, and kind of, you know, it's like funny hearing you guys talk about the rainbow machine. It's like I feel like that tends to be a very and so watch from afar thing to do. It's like the pedals are capable of so much, but we tend to like just go to like, oh, if you turn all the things up that makes this weird sound, and then it's like, cool, I'll just use it for that then. And like my Memory Man, which has got to be like one of the most beautiful delay pedals in my opinion, like I use it with the all oscillation, all feedback and all repeats up like to full. So whenever I press it just makes this like cacophonous noise. And it's the same with, that's why I have two DD6s, because they have that like hold function that you can kind of like, you know, do like the little like hold function, or like, you know, make like
that really is the only way to describe it with the sound.
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, it's only really all those pedals are being used for all these, almost like, I remember somebody describing it as like the equivalent of doing a drum fill on a guitar, you know. It's just like a little ornamentation, you know, that, and I have lots of pedals that do that. I've got like two pitch shifter, you know, PS5s or PS4s, PS5s, and I have them, you know, at various different settings to do various different things. But, you know, the Disaster Transporter is the one that I use for like just like beautiful, thick, lush, you know, slightly modulated. It's just vintage
delay is exactly how I would describe that, like lush, modulated delay. That's kind of what that does well.
It's gorgeous, yeah. And you know,
it makes whatever you play better. You know, anything that you play into, it will sound immediately better through that pedal.
Yes, that makes sense. And so I guess kind of for both of you, kind of sonically, octaves and delays take up the bulk of the you know, the sounds that you go that you're looking for. Actually, is there anything other? Obviously, we'll talk about drives shortly, but is there, like, do you guys actually use much in the way of modulation, or do you do the bulk of it through delays and octaves, pitch rather than octaves? Yeah.
Mostly through the master transport for me.
Like, yeah,
do either of you have any modulation pedals on your boards?
No, I had a chorus pedal for a bit, and I had a phaser for a bit, but I feel like we sort of, when we start writing anything new, there'll always be like a little foray into like that kind of world, but I don't know why it hasn't, there isn't a record where it's really like just landed for whatever reasons. But I mean, it's not like we have an aversion to them at all. It's just the way it kind of works out. And, you know, there is the thing of, in one respect, it's really fun to get a bunch of new stuff and to like, just, you know, what does this do? What does this do? Let's see how this sounds. But there is also something, I guess, because we've been playing, like, you really know your, I don't want to sound too pretentious, but your, you know, your sonic palate, you know, the thing that is at your feet.
Good use of that. Oh, yeah. I'm into that phrase.
Okay, good, good. your foot and your brain and the pedal are all kind of interconnected. And yeah, I think when it comes to kind of laying down the bones of songs and get into the room and writing, we almost tend to strip things back to begin with, you know, try and just write the songs in its most sort of stripped back state. And yeah, then I don't know why now we always talk about them each record, and they just
maybe
don't quite,
maybe 2021 is the year of the flanger and so watch you from afar. Yeah, who knows? We'll see. But it's so interesting to see, like, to see boards of kind of the size of your pedal boards, and considering the sort of the prestige of your band within, you know, obviously your band transcends math rock, but certainly your prestige of the band within math rock as a community, and there are precisely zero modulation pedals, which for me seems to be like, you know, everyone has one of everything. That's what a pedal board tends to be in the math rock community. And of course, like, you know, when we had Nick Reinhardt on this podcast recently, I had Matt on the podcast as well, another podcast host, Matt Knight from Boss. And one of the things that we found so interesting about that was, like, just why Nick Reinhardt and you guys as well just don't use a switching system like these days, like a, you know, as something like a Boss ESA, which means you don't have to do any hopping around the pedal board. But it seems to be something that bands don't need.
I think Rory enjoys the challenge. I think there's a part of the dancing around the board that's quite good fun to him. I mean,
absolutely. I mean, it's part of, like, I like to feel, and I feel this is important, that it's like there is a kind of energy to everything. And I think there's a road in which you go down convenience. And at the end of that road is just something which is no longer
complacency.
Well, not complacency. It's just no longer. It's like, okay, so take the analogy of a guy's learning how to paint, and he's making these paintings, and he's trying to paint what he's seeing. He's trying to, like, he's interpreting this thing, and eventually he gets so good at painting that it becomes like a photograph, and then you can't tell the difference between the photograph and the real thing. And it's like, what is he saying? What is it that he's bringing to the party here? Why do I want that painting? Because you want to, you know, it's an expression, like, music is an expression of, you know, people, and a live show is a version of that thing being kind of presented to you in real life. And I think you know,
a Switch is a little bit too close to having a laptop do it for you, I guess. For you guys, I
don't know. Yeah, it's just like at some point, you know, it's like, okay, it sounds like the CD, or at some point there can never be a mistake made. But it's like, those are all the best bits, you know, those are the bits where you're like, holy shit, I'm like, there's a human in front of me doing something, and it's
perfections and it's, in imperfections. Yeah, I get that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's just always the way I've been, you know. I mean, my favorite bands are the bands who, you know, are scrappy and, you know, don't have a big rig in the background, you know, making sure everything goes clockwork.
Yeah. Okay, well, this is great. You've made me feel terrible about myself and using a Switcher, so thank you for that.
Sorry, if I'd have known you had a Switcher, I wouldn't have gone on the tirade there.
That's totally fine.
Yeah, the caveat to that is that is I'm only speaking on like my feelings about me playing my music to people, and that's the way. Like, I. You know, if I went to a Meshuga show and they were trying to like all like hit their pedals, and you know, Thomas Hack didn't have a click and nothing was, you know, I'd be really pissed off, because it's like, no, yeah. Meshuga, it's got to be like, you guys know the score, it needs to be a certain way. Yeah. But for us,
it's just a complicated click track. That's Meshuga. So yeah, it's that is what that is. But no, you're absolutely right. To be honest, you know, I use a Switcher for switching between. I have three sounds. I have clean, drive, and ring modulated. So there's no excuse for me using a Switcher other than the sort of self-obsessed arrogance of wanting to dance around as much as possible. And so being able to hit one pedal instead of three or two at most of the time, it just makes it easier. But I love that it's and do you know what? Your answer is really similar to Nick Reinhardt's, is that you are playing the pedals like you're playing the guitar. You know, we don't bring sort of gloves that make chord hand shapes and you know, put them over the guitar. You play the instrument, and very much the pedals are a part of it for you guys as well. And that makes perfect sense. But, you know, as you mentioned, big rigs. Let's move on and talk about rigs, which actually means we're going to come to guitars last, but that's fine. Let's talk about rigs, because you guys, you know, are one of the bands that I would say sort of popularized Orange amplifiers within the math rock community. But also, you use Thunderverbs, which are a 200-watt bass or guitar amplifier, which is outrageous. That's that's a ridiculous amount of wattage. This is the loudest amplifier you can possibly buy by Orange. And it's quite unusual to see Thunderverbs kind of out in the wild. They're something that have become incredibly niche. So I guess, you know, let's talk about your relationship with Orange, how you guys have used Orange forever, and how you ended up using Thunderverbs.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Spring? Is that you? Warmer temps mean new Allbirds styles. Meet the Superlight Collection, the lightest ever shoes from Allbirds, now in fresh colors. These must-have travel shoes have a lighter-than-air feel and barely-there fit that made them the most packable shoes ever. That means more comfort and less baggage. Try the Superlight Tree Runner with a cushy foam midsole and breathable eucalyptus fiber upper. Plus, they're comfy right out of the box. So what can you do in a Superlight shoe? What can't you do is the better question. And because they're super packable, the real question is, where are you taking them? Experience how Allbirds redefines comfort. Visit Allbirds.com and use code SUPER24 for a free pair of socks with a purchase of $48 or more. That's Allbirds.com. Code SUPER24.
It's fairly, I think you've pretty much in the question answered the question.
I do that all the time, don't I?
It was, it was like we were super young whenever, I'm trying to even remember how the relationship with Orange started up. I mean, as a kid, Orange amplifiers, you know, they were the, you know, whenever I was watching the old Grey whistle test, the repeats of the old white grape whistle test, I should add. I'm not that old. But, you know, whenever I was, like, checking out, you know, it was, like, always the Orange amplifiers that stood out. I played through a twin reverb up until that point, but I just remember being like, wow, Orange, those amps are so cool looking. You know, I mean, that's a lot of my choices musically through the years in the early days, you know, was based on, like, that guitar looks cool, that amp looks cool, that pedal looks cool, you know. It's very
that is how it should be.
I can't remember how things started with Orange, but essentially they were like, listen, we like your band, we're going to give you some amps, and yeah, I think we just were like, well, what's the loudest amp you've got? And they said this one, and we said, okay, give us one of those and a bass amp. And It was because we were, I mean, at the time, you got to, like, remember, at the time, we were, a lot of the time, we would be playing shows where there was no PA. So we were, like, playing in a basement somewhere, and there'd be just a wall of amps and Chris, our drummer, and you know how loud Chris is. So the idea was just, like, if I could get an amp that would be, so that I could hear me over Chris, that's the idea, so... It was a monitor and a amp in one. And then whenever Niall joined, we just got him one too.
And it wasn't really up for discussion. It was just like, we're getting you a Thunderbird.
All right, wonderful. Yeah. And so you guys use the, is it just the standard 412 by Orange? That both of you have a 412 and then a 200-watt Thunderbird. And then, of course, your bass player is running through the AD200. So you've got 600 watts of amplification between two guitarists and a bass player. And of course, you know, the 810 as well for bass. It's a big old school set of kit. Like, it's a very old school setup in that sense. You're trying to be, and as you say, Rory, it's the idea is to be loud without the need for, like, so that your live show can be just as good whether you turn up at a venue, whether you're playing a practice room, as we said, in Brighton, or you're playing a festival. It means you can sound the same. But like, have you ever thought about changing that? Like, we're in this age of silent stages of downsizing. You know, one of the most popular selling amps of the last decade has been for Fender, the Blues Junior. You know, the Boss Katana, which is solid state, has been the most successful amp in the last 5 years of sales. Like, you know, it's we're in this time of people gigging smaller amplifiers and relying on PA systems. Have you guys ever thought about changing anything?
I'm sort of experimenting with some other amps at the minute. I'm trying out a Jazz Chorus at the minute, a Roland Jazz Chorus. Luckily through your colleague Matt, who's been very kind to us and sent some stuff over for us to try, some other cool pedals and some amps and stuff. So yeah, I am trying to work out if I can create a similar sound live that doesn't break my back to bring the amp into the you know, each venue. I just feel like I'm getting a bit older, and the huge pedal board and the huge amp is just a lot to sort of wheel around. So I'm experimenting with that at the minute, and I'm experimenting with a Helix as well from Line 6. So I'm sort of trying to work out if I can sort of retain the sounds that I love, but on a sort of reduced size board, reduced size amp. So we're we're sort of seeing experimenting at the minute. I don't know. We'll see how it goes.
With the, I guess the good thing for using something like a Helix is that, you know, they have the Mandarin 80 on there, which is a really good impression of an AD 30. I think it's an AD 30. I can't remember what they said. It was an impression one. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's not, as it's got 80 at the end. I can't remember. But it's got a very good orange amp interpretation. And I actually think some of the other things on there, they have some matte amp interpretations, which sound fantastic and very similar. And of course, the thing with a jazz chorus is you're able to go in through the effects return, bypass that preamp, and then utilize the Helix for that. Or just because the jazz chorus is such an incredibly clean amplifier, to be honest, you can use the, you know, the front end and still kind of have all that glittery clean. But how, I mean, I guess, you know, how has that affected drive? Because do you guys use the Thunderverb predominantly for drive? You use the amps for drive. Do you have go-to drive pedals individually that you know, have to be on your boards?
I don't think we've ever found a drive pedal that can hold a candle to the orange distortion. Unfortunately, but when we play festivals, we have to sort of try and find something else. And I don't know about you, Rory, but there's never been one that's just been like, ah, this is it. This is the one that kind of does everything. We've sort of been through, I don't know, five or six different pedals each, probably, that we've tried to recreate that sound with. Nothing quite stands up to it, but like I say, I'm trying to see if I can create something on using the effects that are on board the Helix to see if I can get something close to that at the minute. But you know, if I was to go into the studio to record next week, you know, I'd be bringing the orange,
of course,
no doubt, you know. But don't know what you think about that, Rory.
Yeah, what do you think, Rory?
Yeah, I mean, that's it. It's like that big, you know, that big, durable and, you know, fantastically thunderous drive is, you know, it's kind of like we play a lot of, you know, octave down stuff with the effects pedals, and it just can take it. It's almost like switching a bass guitar on, you know, and it's just... Man, they're just so much fun to stand in front of, and like they are. I think we're aware that, you know, at times it can be overkill. It's like, you know, we probably don't need all that ampage, but they are what we have been playing for years, and there's, you know, a lovely little, you know, roundness to the clean that I like. I mean, in a perfect world, I'd have another cleaner option, you know, I'd have like three stages. It doesn't, you know, you can't quite get it, you know.
Orange aren't known for their clean, even on the 200 watt amp. Certainly they've done some great stuff recently with the reintroduction of their Rocker series, which has proved to be a very nice clean. I think back on the Thunderverb, even with 200 watts, I think their clean has a very specific tone. It's certainly not crystally kind of Fender or Roland cleanness.
No.
Used to use a compressor to get around that with the orange, Rory. Is that something you still do?
Yeah, I've got like Philosopher's Tone, and I kind of use a lot more compression than I used to. I don't think, like when the band first started, I don't think I had any idea what compressor did. You know, you'd like press a distortion pedal, it's like, okay, that's great. Press a compressor pedal, it's like, this is shite, it doesn't do anything. But then, you know,
I think once you got better at production, like, you know, on the laptop, and you're using compression so much, then it's sort of like, oh, maybe I could apply this to live as well, right?
Totally, yeah. I think that was whenever I was like 15 years old and, you know, just wanted to sound like Nirvana. So I'm using that, and that does help, you know, to kind of like, with the clean tone on the orange. But I mean, it's interesting what you're saying, you know, about just like the idea of like portability and you know, in the kind of the way things are with, you know, touring. Well, fingers crossed it all gets back to normal at some point.
Well,
but,
yeah,
you know, there is something so inviting about, you know, jumping on a plane and knowing that you've kind of got everything with you, rather than, you know, the kind of hoping that the rent lamp turns up and works, or, you know, kind of being at the, you know, like wondering what amp's going to be there and whether the distortion pedal that you've kind of tried to get to grips with before the tour is going to sound good through something different. And, yeah, I mean, for now, I still love the orange amp.
You favor the rock and roll over the sort of the consistency of, you know, I guess the digital stuff. And that makes sense.
I think, I mean, it's probably seeing Tony Iommi use an orange amp, and it was just like, it's ingrained something in my now forever where I like can't let go of the Sabbath.
Yeah, that's completely and reasonable.
The other great thing about Orange is that when we go to the States, they like hook us up. So if we go on tour in the States, then we can have like a full Orange backline.
They're such a good company.
They're like the best, dudes in history.
They're the most rock and roll like company I think I've ever dealt with. Like, you know, obviously, listener, I have to, you know, I from when I worked in a guitar shop and from everything else, we deal with Orange quite a lot. And from all the companies that I have to talk to, there's no one who's quite as literally just rock and roll. They're not really a company. They're just like these rock and roll people that love music, and so they, you know, make amplifiers because of that. It's such a wonderful thing to be around. So I'm not surprised in the slightest that they obviously got involved in you, and that also you're able to source amplifiers literally wherever you are. They are kind of wonderful for that.
Yeah.
And of course, I guess, you know, when it comes to touring, that whatever it is, 20 mil ply, it does actually matter when you tour as much as a band like you do. Mm-hmm. Having an amp brand that are literally so rugged that, you know, they're virtually unbreakable. You can, you know, throw them down a flight of stairs and nothing's going to happen.
And
to
we have.
Yes.
Well, Johnny has, anyway.
I have no doubt. They do, of course, weigh an absolute ton, but there is something reassuring in the heavy weight of an Orange amplifier that obviously works for you guys. We should talk about guitars, because on the Guitar Nerds podcast, we have managed to talk about amplifiers and pedals so far, and we haven't talked about guitars yet.
Sure.
Because this year, for all of 2020, in fact, Guitar Nerds hooked up with Shergold Guitars, and they're one of our main sponsors for the entire year. And you guys are kind of the poster boys for their newest model, the Provocateur, which is, you know, I guess the first time you guys have sort of united on a brand, because I want to talk about the guitars you used before then, of course, but you know, let's talk about the Provocateur. That's the guitar that both of you are now playing as a sort of a main instrument.
Yeah
they're amazing.
We played Arctangent like 2 or 3 years ago, and they had like a little backstage showroom of like a couple of different brands. And Shergold were there, and we met Rob, and he just kind of like showed us what he had. But there was we loved the guitars that we played that were there, but there was a photo on the wall of this guitar.
So you played the Provocateur. Marauder. So the Provocateur wasn't out by
it
that
wasn't
point.
Out yet. But we both, like Rory said, we go on looks a lot, and we were like, that's so cool. What's that one? What's the one we can't have? And he was like, let's just keep in touch, and when it comes out, you'll be the first ones to have a go on it. So he sent it over as soon as he had it, and we both played it, loved it, and they've just been very kind to us, very good to us, and it's been a very breezy relationship. They hook us up with beautiful instruments and we get to play them.
They are an absolutely fantastic company, and Rob in particular does a fantastic job of kind of supporting his artists.
He's a sweetheart.
Yeah, he is wonderful. But did you guys both go for the same pickup options? Do you guys both play the double humbucker version? Because of course the Provocateur comes in two, I think it's two different pickup configurations. You get a P90 option and a double humbucker option.
Rory's got the P90 humbucker, and then I've got the humbucker, because I just found that I was always on the humbucker option on the other one. So
do you guys use both pickups, or do you tend to stick on one? Like, it's common with people with big pedal boards, even if there are a couple of pickups, to stick on one for everything.
Rory does it a lot. He does a lot of pickup switching. I do a lot less because I kind of forget that the switch is there, and I just get, I'm trying to concentrate too much on the other stuff, remembering the song. But Rory does a lot of pickup switching, don't you?
I tend to go bits and bobs, and but like I suppose my default is like it right in the middle. But
oh really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. For whatever reason, my hand has just become accustomed to like leaving it in the middle, and then, you know, I can like, you know, go up either end for certain bits.
Right. And I guess because you played Telecasters before that, Rory, so was this a deliberate step away from that, or did you find that the P90 humbucker version was kind of was close to what you were used to?
Yeah, it wasn't a million miles off, and it sounded great when it arrived. Like it really did like stand up. I really loved how it sounded, and through the Orange, which can, you know, sometimes throw even really good guitars, you know, at times, you know, it hasn't quite suited. Probably more my pedal setup combination with the Thunderverb, you know, there's a lot, it asks a lot of the guitar, and it sounded great like straight away, and but it played beautifully. It just felt so, the action on it was beautiful, the frets, and I feel like the neck is kind of like into the body by like an extra like little smidge, and it just feels like I'm not a huge dude, you know, so it just felt like, I don't know, it like just so balanced and like it just felt right at home around my neck. So
I think Patrick Egger has done a fantastic job with those guitars, like chunky necks, but great because it kind of appeals to a sort of a Telecaster player, and they're just so incredibly comfortable. And obviously what differed from the Marauders, which I guess were the first guitars you played, they had solid rosewood necks, and then these ones had mahogany with a rosewood board. But yeah, we've been so impressed with the entire relaunch of Shergold. I loved the neck on the Marauder. That for me, like a solid rosewood neck, I thought was incredible. I loved the aluminium inlays, the sort of lined aluminium inlays. That was super cool. And I think maybe if it came down to it, I preferred the neck on the Marauder. But the body shape and everything else about the Provocateur, I think is just fantastic. And so, Niall, you went for the double humbucker version, which I think has the same bridge humbucker, right? It's always Seymour Duncan's in the Shergolds.
Yeah. I mean, Seymour Duncan's just that name that you always hear of, like, pickups that you probably can't afford when you're younger that you want to get. So it was, like, a real bonus to have, you know, these amazing pickups in this guitar that's already amazing. So, yeah, it was kind of... big bonus for us to have.
That's
that.
Kind of the thing, isn't it? Because they've they're really affordable. Like, you know, they're sub £1,000, sub £900, I think, the Provocateurs and Marauders now, which is incredible when you consider sort of the incredibly high quality soft case that they come in. I know soft cases don't, you know, aren't necessarily important to you guys, but incredibly, you know, cool to have such a high quality soft case, which would be a couple of hundred quid normally, come with the guitar. And then I just think, you know, all in all, the features, the button tuners, everything about them, Having Seymour Duncan pickups, and yeah, it was great to see you guys get involved with them, because you know we were big fans of Shergold from the relaunch anyway. So to see you guys end up being very much the poster boys for their new guitar was really exciting. So that, you know, that's great. I'm very glad that you guys have done that. But you know, you also play a range of kind of other guitars. And I think do you play Reverend before played Shergold?
We both got some Reverend. Well, I think I got a Reverend first. We were on a tour in America with a band called, what were they called, Rory?
Which tour was this?
In America, you know, and they had just signed Bliss. They were called Bliss. They just signed a certain house, and their guitarist had a Reverend, and it was just the whole tour. I was just ogling it, you know, and came home and emailed Ken at Reverend, and he was really cool and sent us over one, and then I think Rory got a bit jealous and he got one, and then we both got another couple as well. And they're absolute tour machines. Like they're just like, they work really hard. They'd never break. They sound amazing. They look cool as shit.
We're big fans of Reverend, and Ken is a wonderful man. If he's, you know, so cool. Slightly dauntingly tall, but an incredibly cool fella. What did you both get from Reverend then? Which models did you end up playing?
Went for the double agent because I liked the sound of having, you know, the options at the time. Because I was coming from, what was I playing before that? I was playing the jazz. What's it? The Ibanez Jet King.
Oh yeah. Oh right. Oh, very cool.
And so I liked this idea of having these options with this double agent thing, and then again found that I was playing the humbucker way more than the P90E. So on the second one, I just got what's it called? It's a humbucker guitar.
Right. Was it the same body shape as the double agent? Which the double agent is kind of their offset Telecaster shape.
Yeah, it's dead similar.
So if it's dead similar, but it has a top horn, then that would be the Jetstream shape.
Maybe, quite possibly.
They did like a single humbucker signature version of that, which I think Matt has. Matt owns, and it was called... It's the Matt West signature, but I think that comes with the P90, so maybe that isn't the one you have. But yeah, to be honest, I've sort of gone, oh yeah, what model do you have? With a company that literally have, I don't know, 60 models. Like, it's impossible to know exactly.
I'm just looking at it, and I'm pretty sure it's the Charger.
Oh yeah, the Charger is the...
Yeah.
Yeah, the Charger is... I think it is the same body shape. I think what changes with the Charger is that you have so the Charger is the body shape, but I think they changed the name to being like double agent. I don't know. I'm really not sure what the deal is, but I think because it's called like the Buckshot and the Trickshot if it's got Tele pickups, but that same body shape is the Charger if it's like double P90 or double humbucker. So
yeah,
I'm not entirely sure, but
it's great though, and it's got the bass contour, bass roll off up at the top, and it's, you know, I would use that a little bit for, you know, I wouldn't fuck with the pickups selection, but I would roll off the bass for kind of quieter stuff. And
yeah, it's a really versatile control. I'm very, very into that.
Yeah, we still love them. We still got them. Still play them from time to time.
That's cool. What did you get, Rory? Did you get you got a Tele style one again, didn't you?
Yeah, I think I had one of the OG double agents, and
right.
And I think I just got two of those guys, but
I think you're the same guitar, didn't you?
Yeah.
Like two of the same.
Yeah, because I was using it a lot. I mean, whenever I got the, my Reverend, I was just like, that was the first time I'd kind of, for a full tour, not played my Tele, you know, which I was just playing all the time, all my life. I'd been on the telly, and the when we got the Reverends, it was like they just feel so good. They're like one of my favorite guitars of all time. I love them. When, like Niall said, we still play them quite a lot, but I just ended up getting two of them because we play in like a couple of different tunings, and so I'm like swapping guitars a lot, and I was like, I just want to have the same guitar, you know, in just two different tunings.
Yeah, that it makes sense. To be honest, it makes sense that you guys have gone for Reverend and Shergo, because I think of those companies as being quite similar in that they make guitars that aren't a ridiculous price point, but they are incredibly well built and presented for their price point. And above all, they are touring machines. Both companies, I think, pride themselves on kind of making guitars that are designed to be thrown around.
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing pretty or over the top about them. Whilst they're, in both cases, very good looking and have some wonderful attention to detail, the idea is this is a workhorse. Definitely. You know, it's not PRS. You know, it's not designed to be kept on a dentist shelf. It's an absolute player's guitar.
Definitely.
Yeah, so interesting you've gone for both of those. We are coming to the end of this podcast, but Rory, I have to ask, the Telecaster that you originally used, was it actually a Fender or was it a parts caster?
Is this the kind of like blonde with the F-hole?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's like a 1973 like Fender Mexican and a thin line. And it was
right.
As far as I know, I mean, it came down through our family. It was my dad's brother's before he passed away, and we got it. And it just sat in our house, you know. And it was as a kid, you know, it was like I would pick up the acoustic guitar, and it was like difficult to play. You know, the strings were, you know, these big ancient like brassy strings that I could barely, you know, get down onto the fret. And but there was this other guitar in the corner, which because it had that F hole in it, you know, you could kind of hear, you know, at the acoustics of it a bit, you know, so you could play it without an amplifier. And it had this really super low action and like slinky strings on it, and I was just able to, you know, just kind of make songs on it and kind of like teach myself, you know, like if I put my fingers in these three different places, it kind of sounds nice, and, you know, so on and so forth. And that just was the guitar that I started playing. And I think it was like probably one of my like first ever shows in Belfast, which is like the closest big city to us. Whenever I was maybe like 16 or something, we played this little punk venue called The Front Page. And I remember we were like one of, you know, seven bands playing. And, I remember somebody coming up to me after the show and being like, dude, where'd you get that guitar? That's like an amazing guitar. And I was like, what? Like I didn't know anything about guitars. I mean, I still, as I'm sure you can probably tell, like I still don't really know a lot about guitars. They were always, to begin with, they were just a vehicle to like, you know, put like a song, you know. It was like the easiest way of making a song for me at, you know, whenever I first started. And it's only, yeah, you know, it was only whenever I got a bit older that I, you know, started to just fall in love with them. But yeah, back then I was just like, this is a good guitar, seriously. I just presumed this is probably like not a good guitar because I don't know, it's just like the guitar that was sitting at home. But
I remember the first time I came around to your house, your little brother was having band practice, and the whole band was going through your uncle's like original AC-30 that was like vintage. And it was like, you know, all the vocals, all the guitars, they'd somehow like plugged it all in. And I was like, no, you can't do that.
I think I had a meltdown.
But Ewan was, I guess, similar to Ewan, just like he probably had no idea that it was, you know, this like masterpiece. Like vintage amp, he was just like, oh, it's just always been here.
Yeah, exactly. Like my dad would be like, you know, those are very good, and that would be kind of it. And it's like, you know, but yes, that was a long answer to your question, Joe. But that, yeah,
no, that was good.
The that's kind of like how I ended up playing that. And I guess, you know, it was just kind of like, okay, I like that guitar. I play Telecasters. You know, if anyone ever asked me, you know, I'd often be embarrassed, you know, that I didn't really like know a lot about guitars. If somebody like talked to me after a show, and it would be like, my go-to would be like, oh yeah, I play a Fender Telecaster, and that's kind of the one thing I know how to talk about a little bit. So
that's totally fine. That is the big divide for guitarists. There are those who play and those who collect, and you know, I'm definitely in that latter, and which is you know, not necessarily the best place to be. This week on the on our Facebook group, I posted about the fact that I was getting really into, and at the time that I wrote this, I didn't see anything wrong with what I wrote. I was like, oh, I'm getting really into boutique plectrums at the moment. Like, you know, plectrums made out of weird materials that are maybe sort of 20, 25 pounds. I'm finding them all really interesting at the moment and exciting. And someone, a podcast listener who we know, commented on there being like, this is the most 2020 thing I've ever read. Just go and play your instrument. And there is definitely a rabbit hole that I fall down constantly, where I become obsessed with equipment and not about the actual functionality that it's supposed to perform. So, you know, of course, Rory, you're the other side of that, having created all the music that you have, whereas I essentially am just sitting in a room full of guitars.
You're selling yourself short, Joe. You're very talented.
Boxes and boxes of pedals in our room. So
that is true.
We fall to that as well.
Yes, that is true. Yes, you are definitely part of the pedals crew. Well, that's it. That's about all we have time for on this week's episode of the Friday Special. It's been wonderful having you both on, Rory and Niall. Thanks so much for taking the time to chat with us.
A pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
You can, of course, catch... no problem at all. You can, of course, catch more Guitar Nerds over on Patreon at patreon.com/guitarnerds, or you can join us on any of the major social platforms with @guitarnerds. And we'll be back next week with our regular episode on Wednesday and Friday. We'll catch you then for more of this guitar nerdery. Farewell.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.